Welcome, everybody. Hey, welcome to TechEd 2011. Yeah, you can clap. Hi, my name's Scott Wiley, and I run the Developer and Platform Group here at Microsoft New Zealand, and that's a really, really great pleasure each year for us to bring you TechEd. This is the 16th year that we've had a TechEd event, 16th consecutive year, so for those folks in the audience, this is your first one. I hope you're in for a treat over the next 3 days. For those folks that have been to a few, welcome back. And if you've been to all 16 of them, well, we've got a lifetime award coming for you. So we've got a whole lot of stuff to get through this morning. We've got an action-packed morning. But first, some housekeeping. So if you hear an alarm at any time during the keynote or the next 3 days, then please follow the instructions of the Sky City staff. And the assembly point is at the bottom of the Sky Tower. You can't miss it. And, of course, remember that the venue is strictly no smoking at all times. Might be related to the first one, I think. Okay, so every year we take feedback from TechEd, and we try to design and redesign the event to kind of make it the experience that you, the delegates, tell us that you want. And you're going to see a few changes this year. And one of the key changes I think you're going to see is when you go downstairs later on to what used to be called the Marketplace, which is now the Hub, you're going to see a redesigned and refreshed experience based on your feedback, which says, hey, we want more space to sit down, to talk, to eat, to connect with folks. And we've gone done that, and we've got this great space downstairs, which not only gives you guys a whole lot more room to have a good time, but also lets our sponsors shine a whole lot better too. So I think you're going to look forward to that. And there's a whole lot of other things through the event that you're going to see. The things that doesn't change is kind of the TechEd proposition, which is leading edge technical education for developers and IT pros, delivered by experts in the field, and that doesn't change. And we stick to that as our core value. Right, as I said, we've got a whole pile of things to get through this morning. We've got a couple of great speakers. We've got some really cool demos. So let's kick right off into it. So our first speaker is the worldwide Chief Technology Officer for Microsoft Services. So here's a job that takes me across a whole range of things at Microsoft around leading innovation, technical strategy, feedback to product groups, and our enterprise strategy. He's a guy who's been in the industry 30-plus years. He's probably spent most of that time thinking about some of the big problems that face the industry, the big problems, the big challenges, and the big opportunities. And I think the cloud is certainly one of those opportunities that we have today. So I'd like to welcome to the stage Microsoft Chief Technology Officer for Worldwide Services, Mr. Norm Judah. I'll give you that.
Thank you. Thanks, Scott. Cheers. Good morning, and welcome. It's really great to be here, great to have you here. Haven't been here for a long time. Last time I was in New Zealand was about 18 years ago, and Auckland's changed a bit since then. What I want to do for the next little while is actually talk to you about some of the driving forces that are happening in the industry today and sort of set a context for the rest of the couple of days that you're here to try and give you a framework within which all of this incredible content, demos, and conversation is going to happen. So let's start off here. Where is the cloud? How far are we from the cloud? And I thought what we would do is play forward a little bit. Imagine you're sitting in the same room, and it's March of 2015. And you open up the newspaper, and you read a press release in the newspaper, and there's an article there about a bank that's built this fantastic, highly scalable application. It runs in multiple languages in multiple countries. It's highly available, highly scalable, and has inputs that it takes from people, from voice, from data, from kiosks, lots of different ways of interacting with that system. A pretty viable system. In fact, some of these systems might exist today. But given the elasticity, resiliency, scalability, geo-distribution of this application, it was decided to make it run in the cloud. Now, 2015 might seem a long way away to you, but it's not that far away. And if this application is going to be running in 2015, we're writing it today. We have to be architecting and writing this application today. So in the applications that you're building, the new ideas that you've got, or when you're thinking about taking older applications and adapting them, you should be thinking about the cloud today, because you want this press release in 3 years' time to be written about the work that you are doing today and not the work that somebody else was doing. And so the cloud is much closer than you think, and the opportunity to develop these fantastic new applications or extend existing applications is around the availability of that infrastructure today. And so this session and TechEd is really about providing you with that framework to really help you understand what is possible, what is feasible, and how you can start to do this and work through it today. So let's set some of this framework, and we'll start off with the infrastructure. Some great data that we've got around virtualization and where we are in terms of virtualized servers and physical servers. As you can see from this data, the run rate of introducing new virtual servers is dramatically higher than the run rate of physical machines. But the magic that's actually happening in real time as we speak today is we're just about at the crossover point where the installed base of physical servers will be crossed over by the installed base of virtual servers. So virtualization is here. It's here today. All of you, I'm sure, are running your servers virtualized in one way or another. Some of you might be running your desktops in a virtualized fashion as well. But what happens after virtualization? What is the next step? So this is the step that took us from traditional data centers to virtualized data centers. And how do we go from there to private clouds and public clouds and on to the next step? Part of what is happening is the rhythm of our business is changing. The rhythm of the Microsoft business has traditionally been a 2 to 3 year cycle of products releasing, and if you're part of the TAP programs and the beta programs, you get an early view. But generally, from when one product ships to the next major version, has been about 2 to 3 years. But that rhythm, the half-life of the release cycle, is going to change dramatically. And this is not just about what we do. This is an industry observation, in fact, that the half-life of those projects and products is actually going to go from 2 years to 3 years, and it's going to drop to 2 to 3 months, and in some cases, 2 to 3 weeks. The ability to experiment when you're online with a subset of your users on a weekly basis and get real-time feedback that allows you to go look into the application and understand what's happening is pretty amazing and something that really couldn't happen before. And what's causing this transition has been the transformation of taking software running on the desktop in the cloud and software running in servers and actually converting that into services. That transition that's taking servers and converting them into services is tough work. There's a lot of work that has to happen to do that. If you look, for example, at the Exchange development team, the team that developed Exchange 2010, there are about 800 engineers developing that product. And it's a fantastic product, had some major work that was done with it around storage and scalability, for example. But when that box product, when that server was taken and converted into the service that you see in Office 365, there are another 1,200 engineers that are doing the work in Office 365 to take the server products and convert them into services that can be auto-provisioned, auto-deployed, scalable, multi-tenant, and so on. And so the work to convert service to services is pretty dramatic, particularly when you're taking products that were designed to be servers themselves. And so as you're thinking about the applications that you're building, you need to start thinking about writing your applications as services and no longer as packaged software. And that transition is fairly dramatic, and we'll talk about some of the attributes of what it takes to do that. There's another driving force that we're seeing today when we move on the infrastructure from the data center and look at the end user side, which is the challenge of introducing many, many new devices of different sizes and shapes and colors, and really the user expectations of what they can achieve on those devices versus the enterprise requirements of control and access. Users have an expectation of user experience, but they also still want to be able to get to enterprise resources. They want to be able to get to their personal resources, their personal mail, personal calendars, personal collaboration. But there's also a point in time when they want to get to enterprise assets. And enterprise assets have some set of governance around them. We need to know who you are, what device you're coming from, are you inside the network or outside the network, and do you have rights to do the things that you're trying to do inside of the company? If you're trying to access particular files, particular data, or particular systems, do you have the rights to do that? And probably this biggest change that we're seeing has been the separation that allows anybody into the network, but you still have to have the identity and access control to make sure that only people who are allowed to do certain things can go ahead and do that. And so to frame the sort of 5-year longer-term vision of where we're headed, in this transition from software into services, really think about that as two layers, the software service layer and then the device layer. So let me start off at that device layer. We've been in the device business for many years. In fact, selling Windows means selling Windows PCs. And we've been a big part of working with those various hardware vendors, of building out the ecosystem, and making available to you potentially hundreds of thousands of combinations of hardware that you can run on your Windows PC today. But selling Windows and selling Office is also about selling that whole ecosystem and the device. And so there really are three different models that we operate under today. Let's start off with Xbox. In the case of Xbox, the business model of Xbox is really about the software and the services and not necessarily the device. So in that case, the choices that we made were to do the whole piece, to be fully integrated from the chipsets all the way up through the services. There is only one vendor in that space, and we actually do that level of integration. And that's the choice that we made in that space. The second one is around the phone. On the Windows phone, we wrote a chassis spec that is a very definitive specification of the hardware configuration of the device. And there are about 10 vendors or so, maybe a little more, coming, who are actually building devices to that chassis spec. The benefit of that is we can guarantee that Windows Phone is the same on each one of those. And if you write an application to Windows Phone on one vendor, it'll run unchanged on the other. So in that case, we're very involved in the hardware design as a reference, but have an arm's length relationship to the OEMs who are building those devices. On the Windows side, it's a much broader view. At that level, our participation in the standard is actually at the much higher hardware abstraction level of Windows, where there are now hundreds of thousands of people out there building devices. And so we exist in each one of those three models, and we'll continue to do that across each one of those, making sure that in the case of Xbox, we're making the right choice, phone the right choice, and then all of those Windows devices working with many, many partners who are out there today. Then you get to this integration of the enterprise services and the consumer services that exist, whether it's sort of rich software like CRM and ERP, you know, integration through Windows Server, then becoming Windows Azure in the cloud. And so what you're seeing is this transformation from software, Windows Server, into services and Azure, CRM, you're seeing the same thing, AX, you're seeing the same thing. Leaking over into the consumer side, where you're seeing Bing and these other services at the consumer level, Hotmail that we have today, with the appropriate regulatory approvals. Hopefully the Skype approval will happen fairly soon, and you'll see Skype as a consumer service. And then Office is a blur in the middle, because Office actually exists both on the consumer side as well as on the enterprise side. But you'll notice a new service that we're actually articulating in this view, which is the access and identity control. And what that is refers back to the point that I made earlier, which is that discontinuity of knowing who you are and what you're entitled to do. The Active Directory did this before, but we see this as being a massive change today in terms of the externalization of identity and access control, and providing that as a key entry point into the enterprise that sits in that interface between the consumer and the enterprise. Today, you can think of that even as something like BitLocker, which is around the security of the device and the security of a USB stick that you have, as the physical level of security. So I'll include BitLocker in this description, much as I would Active Directory, as well as rights management and DRM, for example, that sit in that middle tier. So that service is something that we think is going to become incredibly strategic, important, particularly with the consumerization of IT as it happens. We see the same thing happening on application development, and I know this audience is split between infrastructure and app dev, and so I wanted to talk about the app dev side as well, where you're going to see a common set of tools that are going to help you develop the skill sets that you have today, or those same skill sets. If you're a .NET developer, it's that same set of skill sets. We'll introduce HTML5 on IE9, and you'll see HTML5 both on Windows and on the phone starting to become dramatic development environments. What that means is that you now have additional choice. You can actually work on HTML5, you can work with Silverlight, and you can actually work with any of the other tools that you're used to produce these compelling environments. But frankly, what you're seeing in the future is that you're seeing that being made available across a multitude of devices, where you'll be able to develop and have a consistent user experience across those devices. And we'll talk further about Windows 8 at the Build conference. We probably won't talk anything about it here. The disclosure of Windows 8 will be at the Build conference that's in about a month's time, when we'll talk much more about the immersive, touch-based, natural user interfaces that are happening in the Windows 8 timeframe. But from a developer perspective, the skill sets that you have today and the tools and technologies that you have today will continue to be made available. Now let's look at what role the cloud might play in these scenarios. I just took it as an example here, collaboration. And if you think about all the various kinds of collaboration that you can have today, each one of those applications has its own list of contacts, its own storage scheme, its own identity scheme, authentication and authorization, where you have these duplicate contact lists, duplicate storage lists that you have to manage personally and keep consistent. And so one of the dramatic changes that we see happening with the cloud is the unification in this case around messaging and collaboration, where you start to move towards a single set of libraries, a single contact list, a single identity list, single storage, so you can start to share that common storage across all the environments. And this user context that gets established is something that we think is going to be propagated through the cloud and that will follow you no matter where you are, no matter what device that you're on, that allows you to get to this consistent list of information to allow you to share and participate and collaborate with anybody who you wish to do that in the controlled fashion that you like, and do it through multiple work streams, whether it actually is voice, video, chat, mail, or just collaborating in a document in real time. You want to be able to have that context, your context, be consistent and coherent across all those applications, and we believe that it's the cloud that's going to provide that level of coherency and consistency. And so if we step back and then look at this mixture of infrastructure and application development, this is the story that we're showing. The story is around the private cloud and the public cloud and the symmetry that exists between them from a programming model perspective, from an operations perspective, from an identity perspective, and also from a management view. And so the common piece that sits between them is that common set of services that allows you to build, operate, and manage your applications in a consistent, coherent way, no matter whether you're written for a private cloud running inside the firewall, a private cloud running outside the firewall, all the way up through the public cloud to do the same thing. So let's look at that infrastructure again. We've done some tremendous work over time looking at the maturity of the infrastructure that all of our customers are running around the world. This is called the I/O model, and it really looks at that infrastructure across four levels of maturity: basic, standardized, rationalized, and dynamic. And at each one of those levels of maturity, we can actually tell you what a best practice is, what the technology view is, what the people, process, and technology characteristics are of each one of those levels of maturity. And you should be able to work with your local Microsoft account folks to help you understand where you are with this model. But over time, we've actually been able to get some statistically valid data that has given us great feedback about what does it mean to be at one of these levels of maturity. So if you take that top row, which is actually for Exchange, we know that in a basic infrastructure, which is a very simple automated, non-automated infrastructure, you can expect typically just around about 10 hours of downtime on Exchange a year. That's statistically across the installed base that we know of. However, if you go to rationalized, it's less than an hour. So there is real value in the systems of actually moving up that stack. That second row is around SharePoint, which says a typical SharePoint system would cost $23,000 a year to manage versus $1,200 to manage. And so the thing that sort of bothers me is when we go back and look at the installed base that we know of, about two-thirds of the installed base is still sitting at basic. Even with this level of benefit, both financial and time benefits, for some reason we don't see the infrastructure changing. And so one way to think about moving to a cloud-based infrastructure is it gives you that ability to leapfrog to dynamic. And you don't have to do that for your whole data center. You can actually do it just by workload, is taking individual workloads and moving them to the cloud that allows you to move that workload into a dynamic infrastructure that will get you all of those benefits of time and cost savings without having to do much of that work in your data center. It allows you to move that cloud-based architecture really quickly. So what constitutes a cloud? So virtualization does not mean you have a cloud. It just means you have fewer physical servers and you have a bunch of stuff that's aggregated together. It doesn't mean that you have a cloud. It just means you're virtualized. So in the roadmap of going from traditional to virtualized to private cloud, what is the difference? And I think that the difference is automation engines. It's about taking the things that operators would do or script themselves and making them repeatable and predictable. And that's what happens through automation. So let's take a quick look. Here's a very classical application stack. It starts off at the bottom and goes all the way up through the application. Not meant to be definitive in any way. And then here's a list of automation levels: resiliency, elasticity, deployment, placement, for example, versioning. Those are all automation engines. Let me give you an example of placement. Let's say you've got, you're in one of our data centers and we have 100,000 mailboxes that are running. And a new customer comes in, they're a small customer, they only have 10 mailboxes. Where do we place those mailboxes? Well, it's only 10, so you can probably place them anywhere. But if I have another customer who comes in and has 50,000 mailboxes, where I place them physically in my network actually becomes very relevant. And so there's a whole algorithm for placement, and to do it in such a way that you don't disrupt the current running system. That's a level of automation. Elasticity is another, which says, can I grow the system automatically? So when you can go to a portal and say, grow my number of servers from 5 to 10, there's a series of automation engines that'll do that for you. Now, that could either be driven from a portal, but frankly, it could also be driven from a workflow, which is that you know that every day at 5 o'clock, your load peaks. And so the workflow will say, at 4 o'clock, give me 10 more servers, and at 8 o'clock, you know, take those servers away. That is what we mean by automation. But the thing about a private cloud is a private cloud infrastructure does nothing. A private cloud infrastructure will probably allow you to log in, and if you're lucky, you can print. But you have to think about the workload that's running in the private cloud. This is just a random list of workloads. There's many more. But really, you need to think as you're building out your private clouds how the workload is going to impact that cloud. And unfortunately, I see today in many organizations the infrastructure guys worrying about the private cloud and the app guys worrying about their workloads, and these two teams not really talking to one another. And so one of the things that's happening as companies migrate to private clouds, ours or anybody else's, frankly, is those two groups, the infrastructure guys and the app guys, need to be talking a little bit more. And so when you look at private cloud, again, here's a sort of a similar stack. What is the level of automation that you get, whether you're just running a simple hypervisor when you're running virtualized or when you're running on top of a rich infrastructure like Windows Azure? When you're running in the hypervisor, all of those layers that I've called in the unit of deployment are the things that you're responsible for. You're responsible for provisioning, for actually finding new servers to place things. You're responsible for service mapping. You're responsible for automation of resiliency, elasticity. Those are all the pieces that you're responsible for, and just because you're virtualized means you're virtualized. It doesn't mean that you have those layers of automation that you would get when you actually move towards a very rich environment. So if we transform that over to the application development side on Windows Azure, there are several things that come out here. The first part is on the tooling. Not only can you use the standard Microsoft tooling through Visual Studio and all the tools that you're very familiar with today, but there's also a series of open source tools like Eclipse and others and PHP that run within that environment. But then Windows Azure is actually made up of four pieces. The Azure server, which is, think of that as Windows server, SQL Azure, which is the database server, the App Fabric, which is a very rich intermediate data structure that has cache coherency, that has event-driven message-based programming models that will simplify the building of largely scalable and stateless applications. And then the Azure Data Market, which is a place where companies are publishing data. And some of it is for free, like census data and maybe financial data, and some of it is data that you'll pay for. But we see a huge opportunity that will allow new applications, particularly big data applications, to be built in the cloud when a lot of their reference data is already available from reliable sources inside of that cloud environment. And so when you look at that same concept of the stack on an application side, let's look at what happens when you're making the choices to run in Windows Azure, in fact, compared to any other infrastructure as a service. Again, what I've called the unit of deployment. In other words, when you write a Windows Azure application, the only piece that you're responsible for is that little piece up on the right-hand side. But when you're running on infrastructure as a service, whether it's ours or any other vendors, you have to make some choices. What operating system are you going to run on? Windows or Red Hat? Which database are you going to use? SQL Server, MySQL, NoSQL, Blobstore? What intermediate programming model are you going to use? ASP.NET or PHP, etc., Ruby on Rails, up that stack. And you are accountable for selecting that service, the management, operation, and update of that service. You're responsible for that whole stack. So instead of just being responsible for the application, you or the people in your company are responsible for those other pieces in a fairly broad way. So two application models that exist in Azure. The first one is symmetrical in the cloud. Think of that as mailboxes. Mailbox is a mailbox, whether it's running in the cloud or running locally. SharePoint is the same.
File servers are the same. SkyDrive and a file server has the same characteristics. Asymmetrical gets pretty interesting. Asymmetrical is the burst-out environment where you have an application running on-premise that you actually add value by putting stuff in the cloud. Or you might think about using cloud storage for things like video and high storage to have that run in the cloud and do special things with those. And so asymmetrical seems to be the way lots of people are starting off, which is taking an existing application and thinking about changing that application in some way and extending it through the cloud. But any well-written ASP.NET application today, and particularly those that are written in stateless, is a great candidate, frankly, to migrate to the cloud. And so where are great examples? There are wonderful examples being written today of Azure and SharePoint applications across multiple dimensions and multiple industries. And one of them is around media and content management. And we're going to show you a great demo. So I'd like to invite Chris and Jim up. And they're going to show you a great demo of some Windows, Azure, and some SharePoint work that they've done. That's pretty amazing. So come on up, guys.
Good morning, Norm.
Hey there.
How you doing?
Thank you. Welcome.
So we've got a bit of a rugby-themed demo, guys. What's my favorite color? Yellow, right. So I probably better put on something a bit more comfortable. Into the lion's den we go. I got Norm a new jumper too.
Well, given that I was originally from South Africa, I actually have one as well. And given last weekend's results, I thought I'd wear this one.
Oh. So 2011 was a pretty big year for rugby. And one of the favourite teams to clean up are the Australians.
Oh, okay. Let's calm down.
So we've been working with the Australian Rugby Union. We've built them an interesting prototype media management portal that basically shows the power of using Microsoft's cloud platform to manage their media distribution. So it runs everything from the ingestion of field-generated content, potentially by third parties, through an approvals process running in Office 365, back out through the publication of that content out on top of Windows Azure. And so we're going to run through that today.
Cool. So I'm going to kick off the demo. I'm going to start at the ingest side of things. So I'm going to be Benjamin. And Benjamin's going to provide some content, which is going to get reviewed and approved by RU, and then later used. We've got a ASP.NET app running in an Azure web role. I'm going to log in using LiveID, which is going to use the ACS.
So that's using the AppFabric access control service to federate with Windows LiveID and other identity providers such as Google and the ARU's on-premise Active Directory.
So you've now taken this video at a game and you're trying to make it available?
We've got a little bit of a...
Jim's a dirty stringer. Right, he's out there shooting video freelance styles.
I'd like to state up front that I do not...
But he's put together a great video for this weekend's awesome test match at Suncorp. Who's going to watch it? With bated breath. He's going to upload that into Windows Azure Blob Storage via Silverlight. So he's...
He's not going to upload it.
Oh, hello, says Jim.
Oh, I don't think we'd get the demo fault this early.
Refresh.
Are you in private mode?
No.
Anyway, he's going to upload this video.
You can try and upload the video. It worked this morning.
Are you running in private mode?
No, it's fine. See, the exact same video I uploaded.
There you go.
Three.
The demo
so that's going up. Let's watch that video while we wait. So awesome video for this weekend's this match. Nice pumping that's up music.
Nice try.
Awesome try.
Yeah,
awesome
great.
Try, Norm. So I quite enjoyed that video, Jim. I thought it was a good piece of work.
It's last year, I think.
So obviously we've now uploaded that video. Jim's going to add some metadata about it, including the players in it, the various locations of the matches and so forth. And then that video is going to be saved up, and we're going to kick off a transcode process in a Windows Azure worker role. So basically, we can spin up a bunch of Windows Azure worker roles in periods of peak demand. That's that elasticity you were talking about, Norm.
Yeah.
Right, to really crunch through all this video. And then when the big match is over, right, and Monday morning hits, and various New Zealand commentators are crying into their tea leaves, we can turn all of those worker roles back off. So we basically push that out for transcoding. All of the details for the matches are coming from CRM Online. All of the data is stored up into SQL Azure, and then we push a copy of that data into a SharePoint list in Office 365, And that's going to allow us to manage the approvals process back at the ARU. So if we switch over and now sort of change hats and act as Alan Brewer, who is the ARU's duty media manager. All right, so he's over in a SharePoint site in Office 365. He's going to jump into the list of newly uploaded content. He's got to approve this. You can see this piece of content we've uploaded, jump in, hit edit item, and we're going to get some reuse here. We're going to reuse the Silverlight component that we had before inside this approvals process. We're going to go
so
really,
this is
really
running on SharePoint, on Office 365. This is in the cloud as well.
This is, everything is in the cloud today, guys. We are taking a, you know, we have bet entirely on Microsoft's cloud platform. So we're going to approve that for third-party use.
Are we going to watch the video again?
No.
Okay. I'd like to watch the video again.
No.
Who wants to watch the video again?
No.
No one. Right. That was a resounding no. So we've saved that. It's run another SharePoint workflow. So we've got all of our business logic encoded in SharePoint workflows up in the cloud. And that's now approved that content to be published out on the site. So Jim's now going to wear a different hat.
Figuratively. So we've taken our content, we've uploaded it, ARU have approved it for use, and now we're going to take a look from the consumer's perspective. So I'm now going to be Alistair, who's going to be writing an article on Adam Ashley Cooper.
And who's a pretty decent outside
Sentinel.
Yeah,
nice try there, yeah.
It was an awesome try.
Yeah. So I'm just going to punch in Ashley here.
Now this is back in Azure. This is an Azure
portal. This is an Azure, yep. Portal in Azure.
So we searched through, and if the demo gods are kind, our transcode is still running on our uploaded video.
This is called asynchronous operations, ladies and gentlemen.
But we used the one I prepared earlier.
Like a good Alison Holst.
So we've got the, we do have that video uploaded. So Alistair's going to go through. The main thing that he needs to do really is request a license, because as we all know, it's all about the license. So Alistair's going to put in here, he wants an enhanced license. 14-day duration, other requirements needed for tens, hash tens, get your tags in. And I'm going to submit that through, which again is going to write out to an Office 365 SharePoint list, and it's going to go through to the ARU again for approval.
So it's going to come back over to Alan. Alan's going to jump back into SharePoint. Have a look at that list of license requests. Right, and he's going to see that license request, and that license request asks for those additional terms, which means we actually need to write a physical license up. What do we write documents in, folks? Word, right? So we're going to open this up in Word. Jim probably preempted me there just slightly.
Good. Right? Reload.
And so we have some support here to help in this document authoring. We're going to pre-generate sort of the pro forma contract, and then we have a Word add-in that allows us to preview the video and start inserting some pre-canned contractual clauses that are in turn being pulled out of another SharePoint list out of Office 365. All right, so we're going to dump in a couple of clauses. Obviously, he's got it for 14 days. We're not going to let him edit it because it's awesome enough as it is. Right?
Well, it could be trimmed ever so slightly.
And if we then save that, once again, back to SharePoint, workflow, workflow, workflow. That workflow is going to notify Ben that his license is approved, right? And publish that license up onto the portal for him.
So now that we've got that license request through, it needs to go back out to our consumer. The consumer's going to grab a copy of that through the My License tab. We, touch wood, we'll see a pending license. We do. And we see that we've got our license agreement here. I'm going to go ahead and confirm that license. And once I confirm the license, I'm going to get the HTML code that I can then embed.
Oops. You would have got the HTML.
The HTML code that I can embed. Okay.
That works.
The so demo gods.
We've taken our video and we've uploaded it for ARU. They've approved it. We've got our consumer to use it. He's got his HTML fragment, so he's embedding that into his website as we speak. I think we're done.
And this has been an all-in-the-cloud demo, folks. So literally from woe to go, everything's been running out of Microsoft Cloud. And it shows that you really can build a rich line-of-business application entirely using cloud services.
So great.
Thanks for having
Maybe
us.
Maybe we
all.
Could watch that bit. No, okay, good. We won't watch it again. Thanks, guys. I think I need to flick this. There you go. And so let me finish on this. The road ahead is actually pretty fantastic. The road ahead actually is not the road ahead, it's the road today. When you look in the rearview mirror in your car when you're driving, what you're actually going to see behind you is where we were yesterday, but not where we're going to be tomorrow. The road ahead is about the cloud. The road ahead
is about private cloud, it's about public cloud. And really, the things that you're doing today, when you're thinking about architecting and building new applications today, think about doing that in the cloud. Think about what you might do on the infrastructure, and think about what you might do in the application platform. Because that press release that we showed you up front, that could be your press release describing a great application that you're writing and you're planning today. We've got some fantastic content for you the rest of the conference. There's some deep drill downs on what you saw here today and some other great examples both on the infrastructure side and the app side. This has been great. I hope you guys have a wonderful week. Thank you.
Excellent. Hey, thank you, Norm. Thank you very much. So obviously we've been alluding to an event, another large event that's happening in about roughly 16 days' time. And it's an event that Microsoft is incredibly proud to be an official sponsor for the Rugby World Cup 2011. And you know, we believe that it's a great chance for Microsoft New Zealand, this is a local sponsorship, to get behind the largest international sporting event that's graced our shores forever. And it's one that connects with Kiwis and is a great thing for our country. And so it really was an opportunity that we couldn't miss. So let's take a quick look at a video. One second.
It does give me great pleasure to formally announce Microsoft as an official sponsor of Rugby World Cup 2011.
So in a very few moments, we're going to show you some of the really cool technology you're going to be able to experience with the Rugby World Cup. But first of all, I'd like to invite to the stage former All Black captain, Rhodes Scholar, businessman, the last man to hold aloft that cup back in 1987. Please, big ticket welcome for David Kirk.
Thank you, Scott. It is great to be here. It gives you the goosebumps, doesn't it? Watching that footage, and it's coming around really, really fast. I'd just like to congratulate thank Microsoft for becoming an official sponsor of the Rugby World Cup. I think it's great for the event that such a company with such comprehensive services and reach and capability has taken up the sponsorship, and clearly, judging by all the things that some of the things that are on display today and the things I know, they can do a fantastic job, so thank you Microsoft. Now, life is a very strange thing. You know, I grew up in Palmerston North. It's a local primary school. Running around there as a kid, thinking about what my future might be, I never figured ever I'd play for the All Blacks, that I'd captain the All Blacks, and I'd be the captain when we won the Rugby World Cup. Funnily enough, I've become sort of known in New Zealand for two kind of iconic things. One's, of course, holding up the cup, and the other one is the biggest tech deal in New Zealand's history. The purchase by Fairfax Media of Trade Me for $750 million right at the beginning of 2006. The first one is a really strange one, holding the World Cup. You know, I thought at that time that I would be like the first of many All Black captains to hold the World Cup. So did you. And I've kind of become crystal, because I've been the only one, because I haven't won it since. I've become crystallized sitting there as that guy that everyone shows. You know, as soon as someone else wins the World Cup, and I think it's going to be this year, half of me at least is going to dissolve. And I won't have to be the guy. I want to talk very quickly. I've got my speaking is divided into two. I've got a period now, and then Nigel's going to come up and show some really cool demo around Rugby World Cup technology that Microsoft's working with, and then I'm going to come back and talk. I want to talk very quickly, not about the 1987 Rugby World Cup, but about the Trade Me deal. I know some Trade Me people out there, so great to have you here. I started at Fairfax as the chief executive of a media company that was completely dominated by metropolitan newspapers. And even in 2005, it was pretty bloody obvious that owning metropolitan newspapers, which were very heavy with classified advertising, was a doomed place to be. And now, of course, that's coming true in spades all over the world. I'd arrived a little bit late in terms of being ready to be able to own some of the classified propositions or some of the big internet properties in Australia, because they were already well established. But Trade Me was a fantastic opportunity. I remember ringing Sam Morgan a month after starting in the job, having the first meeting, and I started about September, and the first meeting in November, after which he said, "Oh, I thought you guys weren't even remotely interested. You didn't seem to be putting on enough kind of interest in the company. Didn't seem exciting enough for you." I was actually really excited, but I was trying to play it really cool, thinking if I look too excited, the price will be too high. The price was bloody high anyway, so I shouldn't have worried too much about that. But so the deal moved on very quickly from that. It was about January that we decided that we really wanted to push ahead and try and do the deal. Sam said there was another person in the running. They were already there. They'd already set a price. So that's my one small excuse when I say to people that, I know everyone says to me, "Oh, you paid so much money for Trade Me." I say, "Yeah, but we had to match the price that was there." It was a different deal structure, but we basically matched the price, and we got the deal done in about a month. The rest of the deal, apart from two meetings, the deal was all done on the telephone, except when we came at the end to... Sam told me he did the final deal, agreed the price, CBS were going to buy the deal, we just got to do the due diligence and write the contract now. He was an open plan area and Trade Me, put the phone down, and he went, "Yoo-hoo!" Anyone said, "What are you talking about?" I said, "Oh, I can't talk about it." So within a month, the deal was done, basically. Flew over to Wellington, signed the deal on a Sunday night in lawyers' offices, and all these people who had been early investors in Trade Me, you know, they came from farms and small areas, sort of trooped in, signed the document. Went out that night, not with the Trade Me guys, no doubt they went out that night too, but we went out that night as the Fairfax people, had a hell of a hangover the next morning, had to front the press in New Zealand, and it was the same day that we were releasing our results in Australia, my first results as chief executive of a big Australasian media company. So we announced the deal in New Zealand, talked to the Australian press, and then jumped on our own, only time I think just about had been on a private jet to fly back from Wellington to Sydney to be back in time to make the announcement of our results before the market opened 10 o'clock in Sydney. Got back there and then had a press conference with all the analysts and shareholders. And to a person, they said, "Why were you so stupid to spend $750 New Zealand million dollars on a little company in a small country like New Zealand? You must be stupid." And then they said to me, well, Rupert Murdoch, because it was 1 month before News Corp had bought MySpace. And he said, he paid $580 million for a business that's got 40 million users, is going to take over the world, is going to be the greatest business that's ever been. And you idiot, you paid $750 million for this little business in New Zealand. Well, I say, look and learn, Rupert. MySpace never had a revenue model never had the fantastic, tight, well-organized organization, great code writing, great ability that TradeMe's got, wasn't as well-positioned in the market, and the rest, of course, is history. That's it for me for my first session. I think Nigel's next, and we're going to talk Rugby World Cup online.
Thanks, David. So, thanks. So I spent the last 2 months working as a technical project manager for Microsoft, but for the Rugby World Cup. And what I wanted to do this morning is talk about a couple of projects that we've released recently. So the first one is the first15.co.nz site. And what we've done with the First 15 is Microsoft New Zealand is giving away our box at the final of Rugby World Cup for a New Zealander and 14 of their mates to fly from anywhere in New Zealand to take a part of the tournament and really hopefully see the All Blacks win. Now, this site was built by Provoke here in Auckland using the latest Microsoft web technology stack. It's ASP.NET, MVC3, and the entire Windows Azure platform, using App Fabric for access control services, which was released on the 1st of July for the integration with Facebook piece. And everything that we're seeing here is essentially following through from what Norm showed earlier as a full cloud platform. This was released nationwide through the Sunday Star Times, and it was delivered to hundreds of thousands of New Zealanders using scaled instances to monitor the audience as we were going along. Now, anyone who was at TechEd last year would have seen me on stage doing a really technical end-to-end Microsoft Media Platform demo for a live sporting event. I think I had John Papa here, and I did the boxing match, and we were playing it out on mobile phones, Windows Phone 7, tablet PCs, and showing what was possible in regards to media for a live sporting event. I'm happy to say that this morning, the IRB and Rugby World Cup have released the video platform for the tournament that's starting in 16 days' time. And this is 1 year on from standing up and doing this demo. And through the sponsorship that Microsoft has taken on with the event, we've been able to deliver a comprehensive video media platform that's really going to excite and engage people all over the world, especially those fans here in New Zealand. So if you go to rugbyworldcup.com today, you'll see the announcements and you'll see that platform unfolding. But some of the things, some of the magic for this video platform is not going to come to light until the tournament starts in 16 days. But what I want to do here is I want to show you some things that have not been shown anywhere else in the world to give you a sneak peek of what it's going to be like. This here is an example of the screen that's going to come up on the first day of the tournament, and you'll see every one of the 48 matches that are going to play out in Rugby World Cup. You'll be able to log into the website. You'll get first half highlights 1 minute into half time across all of the platforms. At the end of the match, 1 minute after the match, you'll get full match highlights. And then here in New Zealand, 24 hours afterwards, you'll get a full replay of the entire match with all the integrated data and player stats for every individual moment of the game. And the way that's going to look is there's going to be a scrub bar along the bottom that's breaking out the match into the two 40-minute segments. And then all of the information for choosing player stats, scoring details, play-by-play, all that information really constructed in real time. But looking at PowerPoints, I actually think it would be good to have a look at a live demo. So if we can switch to my machine, this is a preview here of what it's actually going to be like. And this is using Microsoft Smooth Streaming and Silverlight, and this content is coming over the cloud from and cached through Akamai Content Delivery Network. And what you'll see along the bottom are all the key moments of the match. If I bring up the scoring details here and I scrub along the match, you'll notice that the scoring is updated and the match is actually going to show those changes in the score and the information in real time. If I hide those scores, we can see the team stats also being constructed in real time along the side of the video. And if I go into full screen, You can see the sit-back experience. I can go to key moments, like when this try is scored by Fiji. I can navigate to that, and then we could actually have a sit-back view of seeing this video playing out, adapting to the bandwidth I've got available, going right up to HD high definition, down through my internet connection onto the screen. And if I wanted to, I can also bring up match videos. I can look at those first half highlights. They can fade in and play over the top of the video that we're playing at the back. And I can come back and have a look at all of this information. Now, I'm really excited to say that Microsoft, through our sponsorship, have been involved in such a high-profile project. And I think this is really pushing the limits of what can be done online for a live media sporting event. So I encourage all of you to go to rugbyworldcup.com, take a look around, and especially revisit in 16 days when the tournament starts. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dave. Thanks. Very cool. You could watch yourself over and over again if you happen to be playing. I'm just going to wrap up. I talked the first part of my 6 minutes I had about was to talk about the past in a little bit, about the 87 World Cup and the biggest tech deal in New Zealand history, which I was involved in, give you a bit of insider's view on that. Now I want to talk a little bit about the future and what I'm doing now, where I'm at, but also, more importantly, I think about the Rugby World Cup that's coming up and give you a few views about what we can expect and, in particular, whether I think New Zealand is likely to repeat the success of 1987. Just very briefly about where I'm at the moment. I've left Fairfax, obviously. The relevant part of my working life at the moment for this team is, for this group, is last year I, with a partner, raised a small, sort of 25 million New Zealand dollar, sort of late-stage venture capital fund, expansion capital for businesses in exactly the space that everyone this room is in, and we're obviously going to look to deploy that across Australia and New Zealand. Businesses sort of headquartered here, but obviously with international opportunities. And just to give you a bit of flavour, because it's very much reinforces what Norm, and I'm sure this whole tech ed meetings and conventions is all about, is the sort of things that we're seeing, which are very exciting, are things, a lot of things involving video, clearly, things involving data and analytics, and a lot of new models developing around e-commerce, all of which are cloud-based type of opportunities very often because of the scale and the amount of data that needs to be used, and all of which clearly people are clearly getting over and through any concerns about security or and managing those. So I guess it's, the timing is great. The cloud, I guess, is the preeminent theme, if you like, when we look at businesses and businesses that are trying to establish themselves, and particularly businesses that are looking to scale very quickly. They're thinking about how they can be cloud capable businesses almost from birth. So that's a reinforcement. When it comes to the All Blacks, I think for this room, one of the best ways to think about the Rugby World Cup and whether we're likely to win is to use some of the nomenclature that this room knows really well, and that is to think about the hardware and to think about the software. Now, I don't think we've got any problem with the hardware. The whole setup is perfect for us when it comes to the stuff that is external to the minds of the players, which I think is the software. We're playing at home, and I think that's undoubtedly an advantage for New Zealand. Everyone says, oh, won't the players be under too much pressure at home? Well, shit, we're always under pressure, you know. There's no hiding it. When you play for the All Blacks, when you're the best team in the world, you have to win. There's always pressure on you, so it doesn't make a difference where you're at. But you look at the stats, look at the history. Other teams do not play well in New Zealand. The Wallabies haven't won at Eden Park since 1986, and I can tell you I remember that because I happened to be the captain on the day. By the way, the next match I wasn't the captain. We don't put up with losers very. We don't suffer losers very well in New Zealand, but I did make a comeback, of course. So I think the home advantage is good, and I think if you look at our players, which is the other big part of the hardware, the depth and the quality and the experience of our players, we've definitely got the best players in the world. So the hardware's all set up, we're all set up to go, but I see lots of people in the room's mind saying, yeah, but hasn't that happened before? We've had everything set up for us, we've been expected to win, and we haven't performed. And that's where the software comes in. That's where what Graham Henry and Richie McCaw and Dan Carter and the leadership group generally in the All Blacks, frankly, have been working on for the last 4 years. Getting the minds right to have the players perform at their best under extreme pressure when it really matters. And it's a very difficult thing to describe. What is it about the software, about the mentality, about the way you think about performing at your best under extreme pressure that you can teach, that you can learn, that allows people, us, to have some confidence that this All Black team is going to do things differently than previous All Black teams and is going to be like the 87 team and be world champions? Well, the funny thing about it, and this is why it's difficult to teach and learn, is that notwithstanding the fact that winning the Rugby World Cup is going to be the most important thing in these players' lives ever while they're on the field, it's the only thing that they've got to focus on, the way in which they can best perform under pressure and make the right decisions and not, I wouldn't say panic, that's oversaying it, but not rush things as they did, I think, in the last quarterfinal where they lost, is that they've got to step back from the magnitude of the moment and get it all in perspective. Funnily enough, in order to do the best you can possibly do under pressure in big sporting events, you've got to convince yourself that it's not as important as you know it really is. And it's a strange thing to say. And a lot of that comes through experience. If you've played a lot, if you've been there, if you've done that, if you've been behind with 10 minutes to go and you've just kept playing your game, you've done everything you can to win the game and done everything you can not to beat yourself, because it's pretty easy to beat yourself when you're under pressure, you make the wrong decisions, handling goes astray, and so on, then I think you've cracked what it takes to win in those circumstances. And I really think this All Black team does have that software, because I think it's got a lot of players. It's got 9 players that have played more than 50 tests. It's got a lot of players that were there in 2007. And that, I can tell you, that bitterness of that defeat will still be there. They'll still be feeling that. So they'll be ready. And I'm pretty confident. Who can tell the future? But I'm pretty confident that come the 23rd of October, a little bit of that crystallisation of me is going to dissolve away. And Richie McCaw will be the guy that everyone looks to, and maybe you'll get him up here one day. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, David. Hey, I hope Richie McCaw takes it too, but I don't think you'll dissolve. Hey, so we've covered a whole lot of ground this morning, and listening to the audience has been our last guest, who's going to give us some closing comments. So we have in the audience the Minister for Communications and Information Technology. This is the guy who's responsible in government for our industry. So to make some closing comments around Tech Ed, I'd like to welcome to the stage Stephen Joyce.
Morning, everybody. It's very good to be here back at Tech Heads with all the Tech Heads. I think I've got that the right way around. Possibly not. I was thrilled to come in this morning and be handed my lanyard. I felt instantly more techie immediately. And then they made me take it off. So I'm putting it back on. I figure that will balance the tie, right? So pretend the tie is not there and the lanyard is. Look, I want to just take a short opportunity this morning. Listening to David, I think he talked about getting perspective. And I thought to myself, before I talk about ultra-fast broadband and how wonderful it is, which I've done, I think, for each of the last two of these sessions, that I might just offer a little bit of perspective as to why it is we all do what we do at a macro level. I think at our own level, we all do what we do because it gives us pleasure to actually achieve things and to see things happen. But at a macro level, there's a wider view for this whole country, this little country of ours. And actually, the macro view is this. The reason we all do what we do for our country is to actually make this country go a little bit better. And in this room, there is a couple of thousand people who can help that happen. And I think that's very important. We actually do need to change this country a bit. We need to turn this great little country of ours from one that borrows a fair bit from the rest of the world to maintain its lifestyle, it has to be said, to one that actually earns its way in the world more aggressively, that focuses on selling more of its own goods, its services, and importantly, its ideas to the rest of the world. It's actually a massive challenge when you think about it. We did get a bit carried away in consumption and buying houses and things there for a while. It's one that challenge that doesn't happen overnight. It's actually involved some, if I may take up a rugby term, some very hard yards. And it's not easy, actually, because the world is moving around us. We live on this wonderful little lifeboat at the bottom of the world of 4.3 million people, and nobody owes us a living. We only get what we get when we go out every day and earn it. And we can also see as we watch the TV news most nights that the sea that we're on is getting a bit choppier as we look around the world. It's actually harder to stand out from the crowd and make a buck than it was a few years ago. There are lots of ideas for quick fixes on how we can improve our lot in this country, but a lot of it involves shuffling money around. There is actually no substitute for rolling up our sleeves and getting on with it. So we need to improve our competitiveness. We need to create a better platform for New Zealanders to actually get out there in the world and succeed, to launch their businesses into the world. And the government is very focused on doing that at the moment. We can't actually do the job of getting out there in the world, but we can help with the platform. So things like better trade deals. Tim Gross has just been up in China with a group I was up with last year, the NZICT group, who are up there trying to take up the opportunities to sell stuff into China. To get better results from things like education and schools, investment in public science is very important. Reducing red tapes is an old thing, but it's very important, and it's important in your business as much as anybody else's. A competitive tax system, may I say. It's pretty important as well to inspire people to earn and succeed in this country. And probably importantly for today's gathering, investing in infrastructure, transport, and telecommunications. And I'm very, very pleased on the subject of telecommunications that we are now getting underway with the UFB and RBI rollouts, because I believe passionately that is transformative for this country. After this, I'm going out to Albany shortly to launch the Auckland rollout of ultra-fast broadband, the starting point. They bring the show ponies out, and they take us out there, and they give us something to do. And I'll be dragging a bit of fibre out of the ground, apparently. I didn't know that's where it grew. But that's what I'm doing. And back in December, we actually started this exercise with a little school in Whangarei called Manaia View School. There's some really cool kids there, cheeky too. And we went and had a little look at what they were up to and how they're going to use ultra-fast broadband. And I think it's going to transform education in this country. In fact, I don't think we realise yet how much it is going to. It's going to enable the most amazing content for learners, plus the delivery of professional development for teachers, particularly in little rural schools. There's one not far out from here that I went to not so long ago, Henderson Valley School, where we had an online lesson, a live interactive lesson on astronomy with Granity School on the West Coast. So that's just one example. Last month I was in Hamilton, a little company called Stainless Design. Business is, of course, a priority users under the ultra-fast broadband. It's a big opportunity there. They've got an offshore design team to go with their New Zealand-based design team, and they've got a problem with internet connections. Sadly, the problem's been at this end. Now, that end is in Bangladesh. Internet's pretty good there. So they're working on that, and that's a great opportunity. And yesterday I was in Tauranga. We were launching the Tauranga rollout at a place called MetLife Care, and that's all about health and remote monitoring of chronic health patients, which again I think is such a huge opportunity. So as you know, it's not about the pipes, it's what you do with the pipes. We've got a plan around e-business, e-education, e-health, e-government, e-development, all those things. But actually things like cloud computing, the subject of this conference, is so important to make sure we realise the benefits of this ultra-fast broadband for New Zealand. And cloud computing, of course, has now moved out of the buzzword territory, and has become this powerful tool for extending IT. I don't need to tell you all about cloud computing. In fact, if I do, you are at the wrong conference, okay? If you don't know more about this than me, then you are definitely in the wrong place. All I wanted to say this morning was there's a role for government, which is to provide these sorts of platforms and encourage these things to happen, particularly the infrastructure but the big role is actually for you. We can spend a lot of time talking about how we turn this country into a more successful little place, but actually it's really simple. We just need to work on our ideas. We need to encourage innovation and innovators. We need to encourage and support our entrepreneurs. We need to exalt the idea that we're a little country of world-class traders, a country that takes pride in our success, and a country that is confident in its place in the world. If we can do that, then we can take the innovations of the day, like things like ultra-fast broadband and cloud computing, and we can turn them into something that we can all be very proud of and become a much more prosperous little country once again. Thank you for your time this morning. Enjoy your conference.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Stephen, and thank you to all our speakers, to Norm Judah, David Kirk, and Stephen Joyce. So we have covered a whole lot of ground this morning. So I guess the thing now is there's 3 days of deep immersion in all kinds of things. So we've got 170 sessions from 140 speakers over 15 tracks. We've got the industry's biggest party on tomorrow night. Go out there, have a fantastic time. Thank you very much.
Xbox 360, the tournament's official game and console bundle. Out now.